Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views, and for the next hour, they're going to be the views of Dan Hamburg. And Dan was a congressman for one session some years ago, went back to Washington, you know, full of idealism, wanted to make a better country, and well, sometimes the best laid plans of mice and men sometimes go astray. And Dan came back, I think, somewhat disillusioned after what he'd seen in Washington, D.C. But, of course, he's very, very concerned today about what's happening to our country, about the move towards a police state. And as a result of his concern, he, along with a friend, have written an article that was published in the San Francisco Chronicle, of all places, going into the background of so many of the laws that have been put in place that will allow the implementation of a police state in the United States, laws that most Americans are totally unaware of, and yet, of course, you must understand, if we don't take a stand against this authoritarian move, all they need to do is provoke any sort of a crisis. They could say we have a terrible epidemic. They could say we have a terrorist attack, and certainly they could feign a terrorist attack like they feigned the Gulf of Tonkin incident. It didn't occur, and 58,000 American boys died in South Vietnam for no reason at all. Just as they feigned the attack on the battleship Maine, back in 1898, and of course there was no attack on the battleship Maine. The explosion came from on board, but that not only led to the death of 5,000 Americans, but between 200,000 and 1.5 million Filipinos in the Philippine-American War, which most Americans have never even heard of. But you should, to understand that the same forces are at work today. They were at work in 1898, they were at work in Sydney in 1964 or 1965 in the Gulf of Tonkin, and they could very well feign another terrorist attack or an attack of some sort to justify the implementation of a dictatorship, because there are people who have a different set of values, who have a different worldview, and their dedication is not to America, but to the establishment of a world government, the establishment of a new world religion, and the establishment and the enthronement of a new world leader. Well, with that as the background, Dan, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Well, it's good to be with you.
All right, fine. Well, why don't you just tell our listeners a little bit about who you are, and then, of course, why it was that you wrote that editorial. And even more than that, how did you ever get the San Francisco Chronicle, of all places, to publish it?
Well, as you mentioned, I was a U.S. congressman and came in with the idealism of beginning of the Clinton administration, and from my point of view, that was a very heady time, and I believe that the potential for a lot of very positive change. And as you said, within 2 years, the contract with America had happened, and Newt Gingrich had taken over Congress, and the Republicans had regained the House of Representatives for the first time in more than four decades. And the country since then, I think, has been in kind of a regression, which I think became much more serious with the events of 9/11 and the opportunity that presented to some of these forces that you were talking about, the forces that do not particularly love freedom, do not particularly believe in the Constitution and the Bill of Rights and the idea that a free society is the best way to proceed. And I believe that they used those events of 9/11 to create a structure whereby, under a multitude of circumstances, complete control can be taken of the government and of the country by the executive. I think probably a lot of your listeners have heard of this concept of unitary executive, which was something that was put forth originally by a University of California Old Hall Law School professor named John Yoo. But certainly there were a lot of other proponents of it within the neocons who surrounded George Bush. And the idea was basically that, you know, it sort of goes back to Richard Nixon, which is that if the president does it, it's lawful. And Bush said about George Bush, and, you know, I really don't believe George Bush is anything more than a front person for much more intelligent and much more sinister forces. But they did put into effect a series of laws, which Louis Seiler and I outlined in this article, which make it possible for this kind of control to be taken over the entire country. And, of course, you know, your listeners probably know that this would not be the first time. I mean, suspension of habeas corpus, for example, which is a right that goes back to the early 13th century, to the Magna Carta, and is enshrined in our Constitution, the right to know the reason for which you have been detained when you are detained by the state. You know, this is a right that you know, for the was first challenged back in the time of the Civil War by Abraham Lincoln, who, you know, I think many of us believe is one of our greatest presidents. So I'm just saying, the things that we're seeing now, it's not that they've never happened before in history, but we are seeing a confluence and a concentration of power that I think is unprecedented in the history of the country.
Well, I certainly share your concern, and I think it's so vitally important that people understand that a series of laws have been passed, which most Americans are not aware of, that have laid the foundation for the establishment of a dictatorship in America.
Yes, well, that's you know, that's certainly true, and you know, some people say that it actually began on the day of 9/11. Or on maybe the day after, when Bush basically declared that you know, that any citizen who was found to be working against the...
Hold that thought, that we're going to have to bring our other stations on board. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Dan Hamburg, and Dan, of course, is talking about what's going on today, and just this basic idea that we are witnessing the loss of freedom here in America in the name of course, fighting those wicked terrorists, Osama bin Laden, who's hiding in a cave over in Pakistan with a laptop computer on his lap, planning on taking away our freedom. Step by step, our own government, which incidentally worked with Osama bin Laden all during the 1980s, when he was, of course, leading the resistance to the Soviets in Afghanistan, and we were financing his effort and the effort of the people who worked with him, and recruiting Islamic warriors from all over the world to go to Afghanistan and indoctrinating with this radical form of Islam. Well, under any circumstances, why, since the 9/11 attack, and we won't discuss the background of that tonight, but we certainly would want to point out the fact that law after law after law has been passed, not to go after the terrorists, but to take away the freedom from the American people. Our government steadfastly refuses to actually secure our southern border, to keep the terrorists out of this country. And if they really were worried about the war on terrorism, they would have very, very strict controls over our southern border. They would certainly have air marshals on every plane. They would not restrict the ability of our aircraft industry to target people or to profile people of Islamic nature. In fact, the airline actually inspects more than two people of Islamic background or Arab background on a plane flight. They can be cited and sued for that. Well, my goodness, I think we have to really get to be looking effectively. Are they really concerned about terrorism, or is this a move to take away our freedom? Go ahead, Dan.
Well, you know, under the dictates of the war on terror, the world is the battlefield. the United States, the internal borders of the United States are considered by the Bush administration to be part of the battlefield of the war on terror. And, you know, I was mentioning just before we took that short break that in the view of some civil libertarians, martial law, in a sense, began to exist in the United States just after 9/11, when George Bush issued so-called Military Order Number 1, which empowered him to detain any non-citizen as an international terrorist or an enemy combatant. And by laws, by virtue of laws which have been passed since then, and by that I particularly mean the Military Commissions Act of 2006, that law now extends citizens as well as to non-citizens. So, you know, I just think as people go about their daily lives, they don't recognize the seriousness of these laws, and unfortunately, for a number of reasons that, you know, we've talked about a bit before, I don't know if we'll get into tonight, but Congress seems to be asleep at the wheel.
Well, they certainly passed the Military Commissions Act, which was the first time, of course, they had ever, you know, passed anything like this, the Military Commissions Act. It says that, of course, it only applies to non-citizens, but they can take away the right of habeas corpus, so they can use evidence certainly obtained by torture. The individual who's on trial doesn't have a right to actually face their accuser. But what is really frightening about that is the courts cannot intervene. They actually put in Article 3, Section 2 of the Constitution saying the courts couldn't intervene. So if you are a citizen and you're in prison, you don't have a right to find out whether you are a citizen or not. The courts can't intervene. The military commission becomes an authoritarian court, and you have no rights, and you can't even prove you're a citizen before that court. And you can be held indefinitely simply on the suspicion that you're a terrorist.
Yeah. Well, I would like to point out to your listeners who are interested in this issue of citizens versus non-citizens being acceptable particularly under the Military Commissions Act of 2006. Anyone who's interested in that, I'll invite them to get in touch with me, and I will send them a very excellent article by columnist Robert Perry, who discusses this issue of the Commissions Act and its use of the term any person, quote, any person, unquote. And the way that term is used in the Act, it makes clear that any person, citizen or non-citizen, is punishable as a principal under the Military Commissions Act if they commit an offense which is deemed to be counter to the foreign policy imperatives of the United States. Any person who commits an act that is considered to be, and this is the language of the Act, in breach of an allegiance or duty to the United States, knowingly and intentionally aiding an enemy of the United States, shall be punished under the Military Commissions Act. Now, you know, that might sound fine. You might say, well, you know, I'm not going to aid and abet the enemy. You know, you may not think you are. In fact, you may think that your actions are totally patriotic, and indeed they may be. But that doesn't mean that they will be deemed by a zealous government in that same sense. And,
well,
you know,
the
stripping of habeas corpus, the mockery of the Sixth Amendment in terms of the constitutional process with regard to criminal prosecutions. All these things are more than chipping away at the Constitution. These are taking big whacks out of the Constitution.
Well, of course, the President has said you're either with us or against us, but of course,
right.
Many
you're
people...
Right, either with us or you're with the terrorists.
But, of course, you certainly do not necessarily support the terrorists, but you certainly seriously can question what the current administration is doing, sending our boys over to fight in a no-win war in Iraq, and That is essence is what General Ricardo Sanchez said in the speech he gave, and he was a three-star lieutenant general who headed our troops over there. We haven't been allowed to win. Would we be critical to point out we're fighting another no-win war? Would that make us a terrorist? I mean, the implications of what's going on are so frightening, and the average American has no idea.
Well, and then you get, you know, it gets me to what the central question is that our whole editorial really led up to, which is, what is it that this government is contemplating that makes them put into place structures that eviscerate the Constitution and that allow them, perhaps, to detain millions for which they have contracted with Halliburton subsidiary KBR, $400 million contract to refurbish military bases. We also know that it's the Army policy to create civilian labor camps and civilian detention centers out of military bases, which perhaps have been closed under, you know, base closure policies or whatever. Now, you know, I can't say that there's a plan to lock up millions of Americans, but I do know that the facilities are there to do it, and that the contracts have been let with the purpose of at least beginning that process.
Well, I can tell you that there are a number of congressmen who are very concerned about that. We actually have film clips from the Iran-Contra hearings where Congressman Jack Brooks of Texas was trying to bring out during the Iran-Contra hearings that there was a plan to suddenly suspend the Constitution and round up Americans and put them in concentration camps. And of course, he was repeatedly interrupted by Senator Inouye, and we actually have that.
That was so fascinating.
Were you aware of that?
Yes, sir, I was. I'm old enough to remember.
All right, fine.
I served with Jack Brooks.
I think he was a good man. He was concerned about, of course, what was going on, and unfortunately, he was replaced by a Republican. He was forced out of office by a Republican. And although I've been traditionally a Republican, our Republicans today are backing the president's move towards a police state. And all you need to do is look at the series of laws that have been enacted, not, of course, to go after the terrorists, but to suppress any dissent here in the United States. That's what's so frightening, and we even have...
You know what? I don't mean to interrupt you.
Go right ahead.
You know, I've got to say, as somebody who's most of my life a Democrat, the Democrats go along with it, too.
I know. And, guys, that's the trouble. I mean, where are those of us who get concerned about freedom? What was that? Well, let's see. Well, we seem to be having some little background noise there. Are you there, Dan? Dan, are you there? Well, I hope we haven't lost Dan. Dan, are you on the other end of the line there? Well, let's talk a little bit about it, and hopefully Dan will be back here before long.
Sorry.
Dan, are you there?
Yeah, I'm back.
Okay, fine. I thought we'd lost
you. Sorry about that. Yeah.
Okay.
Where were we?
Okay, fine. Well, anyway, of course, suddenly the Military Commissions Act, the John Warner Defense Authorization Act, which, of course, does away with the Posse Comitatus Law. The American people probably don't even know what the Posse Comitatus Law or the history of that law. But now the American military can be used against the American civilians for the first time in history. Rather frightening thing to contemplate, don't you think?
Certainly is.
And, of course, that really was the major thrust, the major concern of the John Warner Defense Authorization Act, which, of course, Kate went through at the same time as the Military Commission Act. But since then, there have been so many things that have happened, and we'll be talking about those with Dan Hamburger in just a moment. But I'm sure that if you can go up on the Internet and Google in, what's the title of your article, Dan?
Yeah, in fact, Google it in, Rule by Fear or Rule by Law.
Rule by Fear or Rule by Law.
And you will get a lot of hits.
And, of course, let me tell you, I was really very taken with that, and that's why I've had Dan with us here tonight. We'll be back in just a moment here at Radio Liberty. Well, Dan, did you get a pretty good response to your article?
I've never gotten such a response to anything I've written in my life.
You know, in other words, an awful lot of people tend to agree with you.
Yes, blown me away.
Have you had an opportunity to be on a lot of radio programs?
I've been on a dozen radio programs and doing a TV program next week for International News Network. And it's also led me to some other areas, which I'm researching now for a subsequent article. I was telling your wife about it.
Why didn't you tell me about it?
Well, I actually mentioned it before. I've been researching this disappearance of the cruise missiles from the Air Force Base in North Dakota.
Oh, you mean when suddenly we find six nuclear-tipped cruise missiles on the wing of a plane, and everybody says, oh, my goodness, and how did that happen? And it must have been an accident. They must have just picked those up by mistake. And, of course, I think we both recognize the fact it was no mistake. I mean, there was a very real reason those were there. You do not simply accidentally pick up half a dozen nuclear-tipped cruise missiles. So what's your take on that?
Well, my take on it is that there's a struggle going on within the administration. I think on one side is the vice president and the remaining hardline neocons within the administration. And I think on the other side are the more pragmatic, say, Bush 1 allies. And I'd certainly put Secretary Gates as one of those people at the top of that list. Also, I think many of the upper brass in the Pentagon I put in that list, and also the heads of most of the intelligence services. But I think there is struggle, and I think we saw it played out this week in the resignation of William Fallon as head of CENTCOM. I think the intention of the neocons is to strike Iran before they leave office. I think they're poised to do that. I think they have the pieces in place to stage that kind of military strike, and I think there are those within the administration who are just as determined to see that averted, to see that as a incredibly stupid and disastrous foreign policy move. But I do see this incident, you want to call it that, at Minot Air Force Base in North Dakota, where these nuclear-tipped missiles were by just, you know, the only thing I can compare it to in terms of the set of coincidences that had to occur to allow this to happen, the set of screw-ups that had to occur. It reminds me of 9/11.
Yes, of course, there was no way that could have happened if there hadn't been somebody who was preventing the Air Force interceptors from intercepting at least one of those hijacked planes.
Well, and of course, why, when the things got to Barksdale, were they spotted? I mean, you know, at Minot, nobody could figure out that they had, you know, live nukes on these planes. And they get to Barksdale, and people go, what the hell's going on here?
Well, you know very well that the fact that this even information even got out suggests that they're trying to send a message to somebody, in my estimation.
Well, and also, apparently there were three high-ranking military
people. Hold that thought. We'll be right back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest is Dan Hamburg, former congressman, certainly a gentleman who's very, very concerned about the move away from freedom towards fascism here in America. And certainly he is very concerned that the Bush administration intends to take us into a war with Iran, and I share that concern. I don't think the average American certainly wants to go to war with Iran. I think the vast majority of the American people do not want to go to war with Iran. In fact, we want to get our troops out of Iraq and Afghanistan, and that's why, of course, they voted the Democrats into power here at the last congressional election. But they should have realized, of course, it really doesn't make a bit of difference whether the Republicans or the Democrats are in control, because the people who really pull the strings control both political parties and have no intention of getting our troops out of Iraq, for many decades, have no intention of taking our troops out of Afghanistan for many decades. In fact, we may very well expand the war into Pakistan and into Iran and go to war with the whole Muslim world, which really doesn't make sense. But then, so much of what's going on doesn't make sense. But Dan was talking about this incident where they found, I think it was six nuclear-armed cruise missiles on the wing of a plane that landed at an Air Force base, and nobody knows just how that could happen. Oh, my goodness, what a terrible mistake. You know, nuclear-tipped cruise missiles on the wing of an airplane that... And it wasn't that sort of a transit spot for taking those weapons over to the Near East, to the Middle East, Dan?
Yeah, Barksdale is Barksdale, Louisiana, is a staging base for Air Force planes to be sent to the Middle East.
What is your take on? I mean, obviously, we've not been told the truth about this, as we're not told the truth about so many things. Of course, in the name of national security, we can't tell the American people the truth.
No, and you know, I just think there are many reasons around which one could conjecture that Bush and his little cabal within the, and you know, they're very strong. I mean, you know, Cheney still controls George Bush, I think, to a large extent. I know that, you know, some of Bush's daddy's people have been put in, you know, around the time of the writing of the Baker-Hamilton report, you know, and they did dump Rumsfeld and bring in Gates, and they elevated Condi Rice a bit. You know, she's considered more of a pragmatist. But Dick Cheney is still the man, you know, the kind of guy behind the scenes, the Wizard of Oz.
But of course, Dick Cheney is simply tied into the real powerful people. He's a member of the Trilateral Commission, member of the Council on Foreign Relations, very close to the Rockefellers. He is part of he is the man who's really controlling the presidency. I think George Bush is just a figurehead, don't you?
And, you know, I don't know if you've made this connection, but, and, you know, I may just be kind of, you know, whistling in the dark here, but I see, I mean, you don't have to be a genius to see that the American economy is really on the ropes and that middle-class people are really starting to feel it. You know, we've got this foreclosure crisis, we've got an employment crisis, we've got a wage crisis, we've got...
don't forget the oil crisis.
We've got an oil crisis, and the Republicans need to take people's minds off of the total shambles that they are leaving the economy in after 8 years. And what better way than to bomb the crap out of, you know, this latest mortal enemy, this latest embodiment of evil in the world. And, you know, rally him around the flag one more time. And, you know, and John McCain is the perfect guy.
Well, I think that we really don't have that much choice. I mean, if I look at the three alternatives, I think I'd rather be shot, hung, or burned alive at the stake, and I don't really like any of those alternatives.
Well, there are no good alternatives.
And, of course, they don't give us good alternatives. They run people on both political tickets, and then we vote for the candidate of their choice. And this is how the system's really won and really run, and I think it's so vitally important that people understand that.
People need to understand it, because if they don't, they don't have the basis on which to act.
In fact, we have a Kerry book. It's written by Bill Clinton's mentor, a man named Professor Carol Quigley. The book, Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World in Our Time, was actively suppressed. If you don't believe that, we have an interview with Professor Quigley where he tells us how, of course, his publisher was purchased and placed in the first half of the book. His book were destroyed so the book could not be depressed, and then they lied to him. But on pages 1247 and 1248, he lays it out. He said, we have a two-party system, and, of course, it really doesn't make any difference. People go to the polls every 4 years to throw the rascals out, but the truth of the matter is, nothing's going to change. It's just what's going on today. Well, Dan, you go right ahead there.
Well, you know, we were kind of talking about, you know, we're getting a little bit into what's ahead of us. And I think, you know, getting back to the article and some of the things we were trying to point to in the article, you know, you turn on MSNBC or CNN, and you know, 24/7, all you hear about is McCain, Obama, Clinton. Obama, Clinton.
Or maybe we hear about Eliot Spitzer, you know.
Backtrack Eliot Spitzer, but, you know, I wonder in my own, you know, deepest thoughts whether we are even going to get that far. Because, you know, as I said, the levers are now in place through which an election can be had or can be canceled. If these guys so choose, under the NSPD, the National Security Presidential Directive 51, which was issued in 2007, no congressional oversight.
And let me,
this allows the president to cancel elections, suspend the Constitution, and you know, you were mentioning earlier, it could be anything from a disease outbreak to a severe weather incident to a terrorist attack, and it could be a false flag attack for all we know. But
it could simply be
interesting to see if we even get to November 2008 and have an election and have a transfer of power in this country.
Well, I think anybody would like to read up a little bit about that. You just Google in Presidential Directive National Security 51. They will come to it, National. That's the Security and Presidential Directive 51. Read about it. Understand the implications of this. And this was simply put in, I think, about October of last year, without the consent of Congress, but it became the law of our land where the president at any time can actually declare this a national emergency, and then without the consent of Congress, for an indefinite period of time, establish a military dictatorship in America. And where was the outcry from our liberal media who's so concerned about our freedom?
Yeah, it is. There's an excellent article that I found on Slate.com, written by a guy named Ron Rosenbaum, talking about NSPD 51.
Well, hold that thought. We'll be back here in just a moment at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan. I guess this evening is Dan Hamburg. And Dan, before we go on, I'd like you, if you have a website you'd like to talk about or you'd like to tell people where they can read your excellent article.
Sure. The website is voiceoftheenvironment.org. www.voiceoftheenvironment.org. And I invite anybody who wants a footnoted version of the article that appeared in the Chronicle last month, I'd be happy to send that to you if you email me at V as in Victory, O, T as in Tom, E, at Pacific, like the ocean, .net. And I'd be glad to do that this afternoon. Yesterday afternoon, I had this conversation with a high school teacher from British Columbia who wanted to use this article as a teaching lesson for his high school class, and he wanted footnoted versions so that his students could see what kind of research goes into creating an article that is published in the mainstream press. And it was quite interesting to see that he was using something like this with 10th graders to help them to develop critical thinking. And you know, I just applaud teachers like that, you know, who are willing to get, you know, out of the mainstream and actually challenge their students with ideas that I don't think most 10th graders get challenged with.
Okay,
anyway, you know, I was just mentioning this Ron Rosenbaum article, which appeared in Slate, which analyzed NSPD 51. And, you know, basically says, you know, there's nothing wrong with planning for continuity of government. You know, what if the United States did undergo a nuclear attack? I mean, would you really want the government not to have a plan to have continuity of government? You know, it's not like the whole idea is utterly absurd. But when you look into the details of NSPD 51, what you find is that it's not only a plan for continuity of government, it's a plan for the dictatorship of the executive.
And
that it means basically that the legislative and judicial branches of government become subservient to the executive branch of government.
And I think that's such a very valid point. That is what it was so frightening. There's no consent of the legislature. There's no time limit. It's an indefinite dictatorship in America. How could that have come about without, be on the front headlines of our paper every day? Or why doesn't Rush Limbaugh warn us about that? Or Sean Hannity,
yeah,
or Brian Williams? Or go right ahead.
Well, it's interesting because if you go to the Wikipedia entry on NSPD 51, what you find is a very conservative activist, a guy named Jerome Corsi, and a very left-wing activist, Marjorie Cohn of the National Lawyers Guild, both talking about this exact point, that under NSPD 51, the judiciary and the legislature basically disappear, and the president becomes a law unto himself. So, you know, we've talked about this before, how the left and the right, you know, start to meet around the idea of things like separation of powers and the idea that you know, a democracy depends on a diffusion of authority and checks and balances. And ideas like that seem to have gone out the window, I think particularly over the last 7 or 8 years of the George Bush administration.
Well, of course, I mean, I think this has been going on for a long time. I think we've got bipartisan efforts to do this. In fact, they tried to get some of these laws through during the Clinton administration after the Oklahoma City bombing.
Well,
but
yeah,
at
absolutely.
That time, of course, the Congress, wasn't about to go along with that, so they had to have an incident much more dramatic, much more threatening to the American people, that would actually change the attitude of the American people so they'd be willing to give up their freedom in the name of being protected from those, from the wicked Osama bin Laden over there in the cave in Pakistan, who we did not incidentally try to catch when we sent our troops into Afghanistan. And we carried a book, we used to carry it, I think it's out of print now, but it simply talked about the special forces people in Afghanistan who wanted to go after Osama bin Laden. They weren't allowed to. We hired a bunch of Arabs who were very pro Osama bin Laden to capture him, and lo and behold, they let him get away. Can you imagine that? But then we attacked Afghanistan because we wanted to get Osama bin Laden. He escaped to Pakistan. Then why didn't we go into Pakistan to get him? Oh, we couldn't do that. That was a sovereign nation. We couldn't go into Pakistan. It's all right to go into Afghanistan, which is a sovereign nation, but not go into Pakistan. Supposedly, we went to war to catch Osama bin Laden. And
well,
look where we are today.
If you believe that...
Well, I don't believe that, of course, at all.
I got a bridge I want to sell you. And, you know, I've got to say that there still is freedom of the press in this country. And anybody who wants to get the truth, they can find it.
Yeah, but it's awfully hard, Dan, don't you think?
It's not easy to find.
Right.
You're not going to find it just by turning on NPR, or certainly not by watching the network news. But if you want to find it, if you want to find the true story of the relationship between the U.S. government and Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda, and some of the answers to the questions that you just posed, those answers can be found. If you want to find out, you know, what really happened on 9/11, I'm not saying you can find out exactly what happened, but you can sure formulate some very interesting question based on the information that's out there, but you're not going to get it by reading the 9/11 Commission report.
Well, that's, of course, the beauty of the Internet. That's the beauty of shortwave. And of course, programs like this.
And this programs is why like yours.
This is why we do what we do 5 hours a day, in the hopes that people out there will perhaps just accidentally tune in, surfing the dial at home or surfing the dial on the radio, and suddenly hear information that has a ring of truth to it. Well, let's go back to your article. Well, why don't you just go point by point through your article as best you can from memory, because I think the points you made were so very, very valid. Don't be bashful, because most of our listeners have never read your article, and I think it was one of the most important articles I've read in a long time.
Well, you know, there's a couple aspects we haven't really talked about. One of them that's very current is this bill that Congresswoman Jane Harman from Venice, California. And I just found out tonight that you guys are down in Santa Cruz.
Right.
For some reason I had you somewhere in the Midwest.
No, we're on the North Shore.
Actually, a brother on the North Coast.
Well, you get down here, Dan, while you give us a call and take you to lunch.
But anyway, you're Congresswoman South. Your Congressman Sam Farr. I mean, I'd be very curious as to whether he voted for this, and I have to assume he did, because this bill, H.R. 1955, the so-called Homegrown Terrorism Prevention Act of 2007, passed the House by a vote of 404-6. So I doubt if your own liberal congressman found it within himself to vote against it. But this is a bill sponsored by Jane Harman to set up a commission to examine and report on the facts and causes of so-called violent radicalism and extremist ideology, and then make legislative recommendations on combating it. So under this bill, Representative Harman and her colleagues will set up a commission that will tour the country and hold hearings to determine who out there is dangerous, who out there is not towing the line of American policy as it's being advanced from Washington, D.C. Each one of these commissioners will have the power to hold hearings, take testimony, administer oaths, like a bunch of little Joe McCarthy's out there working to expose Native terrorism. And, to me, this kind of scattershot approach, just casting this big web out there just to, see how many fish they can catch, could be aimed at anyone.
Well, of course, the thing is, I think that's homegrown terrorists. They're not necessarily looking for Muslim terrorists or Islamic terrorists. They're looking for people who disagree with the government, who really feel that, of course, we're moving away from freedom, that there is an agenda out there. There are people. In fact, I heard listening to Rush Limbaugh today, and he was ranting against Obama, and just saying all the things that Obama's minister had said. And of course, I don't approve of the minister's language, but many of the things the minister said were absolutely right. And suddenly, Rush Limbaugh was shocked that this minister would mention the fact we'd bomb Hiroshima and Nagasaki. What a terrible thing to mention that, as if this was something wrong to do and to kill all those civilians. Well, warfare is not supposed to be killing civilians. It's supposed to be killing soldiers. You don't kill civilians. Of course, anybody who's ever studied realizes that the Japanese have been trying to surrender for 6 months, and we wouldn't let them. But Rush Limbaugh was incensed that Obama's minister would talk about that, would talk about the fact that our government was involved in smuggling drugs, that our government had something to do with the creation of the AIDS virus, or that we had attacked Iraq and were killing people over there. And Rush Limbaugh, and so many good people listen to him regularly. I think he's wonderful and entertaining. But he was just saying, how could anybody believe this sort of thing? And then a couple of people called in. They obviously were not black at all. They tended to agree with what the minister had said. And
Rush Limbaugh said, how did Rush handle that?
And of course, Rush Limbaugh said, can you imagine that people would tend to agree with these things, being critical of our going to war over in Iraq? Obviously, we can't allow that sort of thing. We have to understand why people would think this way. And I'm sitting down, I'm wondering, does anybody really believe Rush? I mean, he's obviously the finest conservative commentator that money could buy. He's simply covering for the very people who are responsible for all of these atrocities.
Yeah. But, you know, it's sort of like, you know, believing the official story of 9/11 or believing the official story of the Kennedy assassination or the official story of the Gulf of Tonkin or the Maine or, you know, any of those things you were mentioning at the very beginning of your program. Believing those things is part of being a patriotic American. You know, believing that the purposes of the United States are always to be altruistic and spreading democracy and spreading freedom. And, you know, if you don't believe those things, you're not saluting the red, white, and blue.
But you see, that's where we get into trouble, Dan.
That's
I mean, I love America, and I'm a patriot, and I love this country.
Am
but
too.
The thing is, that the problem is that it's been taken over by wicked people who have a different agenda and are using our country for their nefarious objectives. To me, they are the real terrorists, and they're the ones Rush Limbaugh covers for all the time.
He certainly does.
He does.
Yeah. Well, you know, the thing that scares me so much about this Harmon bill is that they want to take their narrow perspective of what it is to be a patriotic American. You know, it gets back to that kind of Rush Limbaugh or that George Bush. You're either with us or you're with the terrorists. And it doesn't stop with whether or not you agree with the war in Iraq and the war in Afghanistan. It could also be, you know, how you feel about paying your taxes. It could be, you know, that you're an environmentalist. It could be you're an immigration or an anti-immigration activist. It could be you're a Second Amendment's rights supporter. You're for or against. I mean, the thing that makes this country great, if it's anything, is our tolerance of different points of view and our ability. You know, what is the you know, what are the words that we imprint on our coin? E pluribus unum, out of many one. And we are so far from that idea. You know, now it's, you know, you're either with us or against us, which is just the opposite point of view.
I know one of the interesting things is we have posted on our webpage, RadioLiberty.com, a pamphlet that was circulated in the Phoenix area from the Anti-Terrorism Task Force. It was prepared by the local FBI and circulated to all the local police and was telling them how to identify a terrorist. And one of the ways you could identify a terrorist was he talked about the Constitution. He talked about the Constitution. Go to our webpage, and this is accurate. This is what the FBI was putting out about 1999, when, of course, they knew all about the Islamic terrorists, not one mention of Islamic terrorism. They were monitoring Islamic terrorism, but not a mention of it. They were talking about how you could identify a terrorist. They talked about Christianity, or that they were part of certain Christian groups, or they talked about the Constitution. Now, I would think that would send shudders on the spine of most people. But go to our webpage, RadioLiberty.com, and look up that pamphlet, or we'll send you a copy of it. The pamphlet that was put out by the FBI Anti-Terrorist Task Force. And that, of course, if you talk about the Constitution, if you talk about these ideas of freedom, obviously you are immediately suspect.
Well, I think there have been polls done recently, you know, in the last few years, you hear about them now and then, of, you know, how people feel about the First Amendment. You know, you find the majority of Americans, you know, don't agree with the rights that are set forth in the First Amendment of the Constitution. You know, so we've become quite a self-censoring population. And, you know, it gets back to our educational system. It gets back to our ahistorical approach to the world. Our feeling that politics is somehow, you know, and this is kind of this one thing that I have to say in favor of the Obama campaign is I see some enthusiasm about politics again that is not cynical. And I haven't seen that in the United States for a long time. I haven't seen young people engaged since my generation. And I'll tell you, one of the reasons we were so engaged is that we didn't want to go over to Vietnam and get our butts shot up. But I haven't seen young people wanting to get engaged in politics for a long time. And, you know, I don't put a lot of stock in Obama per se, but I do think that if you raise the level of energy and expectation of people, you don't know where that's going to stop.
Well, I think that people need to begin thinking. Of course, if you look at Obama's chief foreign policy advisor.
Yes. Brzezinski.
Zygmunt Brzezinski, of course, agent of the Rockefellers, just like Henry Kissinger.
I know.
He's the agent of the Rockefellers with the Republican Party. So you got Kissinger for the Republicans, Brzezinski for the Democrats, and he's Obama's, in fact, Brzezinski's written a new book, I think it's called Second Chance, and he writes all about this wonderful young man he's counseling, Barack Obama. Ladies and gentlemen, you have to understand, we don't support any of the political candidates. They're all under the same control. And until the American people understand that...
I do sometimes lapse into a little bit of optimism.
All right, well, we'll be back in just a moment. You hang on there for just a moment, Dan. We'll be right back here at Radio Liberty. Well, Dan, you got 3 minutes to wrap up the program.
Well, it's just a pleasure to be on with you, Stan. You're so erudite, and I always find it very interesting to discuss these issues with you. And I'm glad that you've got listeners out there who are interested in enough to at least consider some alternative ways of looking at what's going on in our country. And one thing you said tonight that I want to stand behind myself is this whole idea of what a patriotic American is. And, like you, I love this country. I've raised my kids here and got 6 granddaughters that I'm raising here. And my fondest wish is that there could be a strong and free and prosperous America that is a friend to the world, that could live on way past my lifetime. And we're not going to get there by going along. We're not going to get there by just swallowing the company line or the administration line. We're only going to get there if we're willing to challenge the prevailing attitudes, challenge the prevailing thinking, and be brave enough to step forward when our time is called. And we've talked about some things in this program tonight that are pretty scary things. And I don't for a moment think that the next few years are going to be years without challenge. I think all of us who love freedom and who care about this country are going to have to be ready to sacrifice something so that our kids and grandkids can maybe live in the kind of country that we all can be proud of.
I agree with you totally, and certainly I very much enjoy having you on. I hope we can have you on in the future. If you have any other thoughts, you'd like to come on, give me a call, because even though we may come from opposite ends of the political spectrum, on the issue of freedom, I think the left and the right must stand together, because if we don't stand together, there is no chance. And I know so many liberals who really are concerned about what's happening, and I respect you, and I really appreciate so much your willingness to appear here with us on Radio Liberty.
Well, it's my pleasure.
Good night, and God bless, and thanks so very much, and we really will look forward to having you on again. Just give me a call anytime.
Will do.
Good night. God bless. All right, fine. That was Dan Hamburg. Hope you enjoyed it. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and we do hope you enjoyed our interview with Dan Hamburg this evening. And he is a very intelligent, articulate individual, and certainly expresses himself very well, and expresses many of the things that I am very concerned about. Now, we put together a DVD. It's called The Planned Police State, where we explain to you all of the things we've been talking about, and we hope that you'll want to get that. It's called The Planned Police State. I'm working on a syllabus. It's not available yet. We'll be in another 10 days to 2 weeks. Somebody goes along with that, gives you all the documentation for everything we've talked about. But the DVD is an excellent place to start, and included in that is the footage from the Iran-Contra hearings back in 1988, as I remember, when, of course, Congressman Jack Brooks tries to bring out the fact that the Iran-Contra hearings, that there is a plan in America to suspend the Constitution and round up American citizens and put them into concentration camps. And this was worked on between 1982 and 1984 by Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North, who, of course, is very well thought of by the conservatives and universally hated by the liberals. But, of course, it's all part of the game. Amos and Andy, Abbott and Costello, Martin and Lewis, and, of course, Abbott. If you understand that the two-party system is simply to give you something for entertainment, to think that there's a real conflict going on there and the candidates shout at one another from the two sides, but in truth, they're all going the same direction, as we can see. When the American people voted the Democrats in so we could get out of Iraq, what happened? Absolutely nothing. They get up, they clamor, they complain, they yell and scream, and we're going to do something, but nothing ever gets done. It's all showbiz. When you understand that, you can understand so much of what's going on today. And of course, in this DVD we have, you'll actually see the interchange between Congressman Jack Brooks and Senator Inouye, who keeps interrupting. He doesn't want the information to be brought out that there's a plan to suspend the Constitution and establish a dictatorship in America. You want to get this DVD? And if you're interested, like more knowledge on it, our telephone number is 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. And then, of course, we have a four tapes or set on the concentration camps in America. We have the official government publication on the use of civilian internees in military army camps. We have DVDs with the footage that we just talked about. In other words, Congressman Jack Brooks trying to bring out the fact that there is a plan to establish a dictatorship in America and being interrupted by Congressman Inouye. That's the amazing clips, and that's available through Radio Liberty. We have a DVD entitled America Behind Barbed Wire, and we hope that many of you out there will be interested in getting these individual items, or there's something called the Concentration Camp Special. In other words, there's a four-tape, a four-CD set. There is the videos on America Behind Barbed Wire, DVDs on amazing clips. That's 3 hours of the most amazing clips you will ever see, bringing you to an understanding of this move towards the New World Order, the New World Religion, the New World Leader. So you can get them separately, or you can get certainly the Concentration Camp Special. We advise this. We want you to try to reach others. We don't like to talk about these things, but it's far better to talk about them now when we may be able to make some difference, or at least get people aware of the fact that there's some very real problems in America. We have, of course, something that Pastor Chuck Baldwin put together. It's called the Freedom Documents. It's all the documents from the Mayflower Compact all the way up to the Gettysburg Address, about 40 or 50 of the major documents that has to do with our freedom. America's a unique and wonderful country. Isn't it a shame that we would lose it because of our apathy and our indifference? So the Freedom Documents are available from Radio Liberty. You'll certainly want to get my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, my talk on the forbidden secret. And there is a secret that's been passed down for 5,000 years, so applicable today. Our number, 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. Please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection.
quiet.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, and for the next hour, they're the views of William Grigg. And William was a senior editor of the New American magazine for many years, and now, of course, he is a freelancer. He works for the Welch Foundation. He has his blog site. He writes articles. He writes books, and of course, we're privileged to have him as a regular guest here at Radio Liberty. And so now, William, we actually have a different audience that we talked to earlier this week. So you can, if you want to be repetitive, you can certainly be repetitive. Talk about whatever you want to. What should we talk about tonight?
Well, Dr. Stan, I really appreciate the opportunity. And if there was risk of being obnoxiously redundant on...
No, you're not obnoxiously redundant. We've got all these people out here who've never heard all this. So go right ahead.
We just have to talk about what's going on with the economy right now, and the fact that we're entering, we already well established in what has to be considered the post-dollar era in terms of the dollar being the world's reserve currency. We're dealing with a situation right now where the poison has been ingested and it's working its way through the system of the beast, and the beast is already dead in everything but name, but there are still nerve reactions going off to give the illusion of life. That's the dollar as the world's reserve currency right now. People are still pretending as if the dollar is the almighty greenback of yore, and that wherever people want to have access to markets and wherever they want to do business, the dollar is acceptable. That's not the case anymore, and it's not going to be the case for the foreseeable future. And the dollar may be permanently done now as a store of value and as the universal medium of exchange, and this is something which is an engineered outcome. It's not something that simply happened to us. It's the result of concerted action and deliberate policy persevered in perversely for a number of decades now. And I don't think that most of the public, even the public that pays attention to the economic and business news, is really quite aware of just how pernicious the situation is right now. And in my blog today, which is entitled Why Aren't We Furious, I talk about a principle which is fundamental, it's rudimentary. You and I have discussed it before. A number of people have done really good work on the subject of inflation and what it is and why it's the cruelest of all possible taxes. But it's a good idea, I think, to advert to those principles once again here. And in order to understand the principle, one of the best illustrations I ever heard, ironically enough, comes from the most unlikely source imaginable. That is the actor William Shatner, who's notable for being Captain Kirk on Star Trek and T.J. Hooker and now Denny Crane on Boston Legal. Mr. Shatner is also a horse aficionado. He's an investor in quarter horses and show horses. And he went into that line of investment against the advice of his family. Mr. Shatner's father was a very successful businessman, and Shatner himself has been very successful in parlaying what he has made as an actor into quite a fortune. But he said the problem with investing in horses is that you should never invest in something that eats while you sleep. Now, we don't have any choice here. Inflation eats our earnings while we sleep. While we've all been sleeping, every single night and every single day, with silent implacability, the government that rules us and the Federal Reserve that is its official counterfeiting arm is stealthily stealing what we earn. It's almost as if they raid our bank accounts every night without leaving a visible trace in terms of the balance that shows up in our register. But every single day, every single passing minute, every second, as a matter of fact, the value of what we earn is being stolen. And that's what inflation amounts to, is stealthy theft by the government through counterfeiting and debasement of the currency.
In fact, it was Lenin who said, you know, the best way to destroy a capitalist society is by debasing the currency, and not one person in a million will understand what's going on. Alan Greenspan quotes that in his book, The Age of Turbulence. but I think it would be said over and over again. Of course, not one person in a million understands what's really going on.
Well, when we listen to the radio or watch television, we quite frequently see advertisements for a number of companies that specialize in protecting people from identity theft. And the nightmare that everybody confronts is the prospect of somebody obtaining your confidential information, your social security number, the routing number for your checking account, things of this sort can be used to access your financial assets and then to vacuum out your savings account or your checking account. And that happens to people with disturbing frequency, but universally now, once again, the government that rules us, the people who presume to dictate to us how our futures will turn out, they're doing the equivalent of this every single day, and that is a policy being persevered in right now for what has to be considered one of the most perverse of reasons, and that is the redistribution of wealth from the people who earn it as middle-class or aspiring middle-class Americans into the hands of the super-rich in the investment community who are politically connected to the ruling elite for the benefit of bankers and hedge fund managers and people like those who are running Bear Stearns, which was the recipient of this incredible largesse by way of J.P. Morgan that originated with the Federal Reserve, conjuring out of nothing a huge increment of money in order to preserve Bear Stearns from financial collapse. They were in a bad cash position. Beginning of the week, their CEO and CFO were telling the public, no, we're perfectly fine, we're liquid, in spite of the fact that they're very deeply implicated in the unwinding of all these debt instruments that have been generated by the subprime mortgage market. And, of course, as the week wore on, their pretense collapsed, and so they turned to the Federal Reserve, and the Federal Reserve did what it always does. It counterfeited money for the benefit of the wealthy and powerful, thereby stealing from the value of what you and I and everybody else has earned or saved or invested. And I ask once again, why aren't we furious about this? The public seems to be very susceptible to transitory passions of engineered fury over matters of complete irrelevance. People tend to find themselves very easily I've manipulated into being angry over the misconduct of some transient celebrity or over some crime that doesn't have any direct impact on their lives or their communities. But here we have the biggest crime in history, which is the theft of our republic and the theft of our earnings through this mechanism of inflation. And the people who are in charge of stealing from us are the ones who define how much they steal from us in terms of defining the so-called core inflation rate for the Consumer Price Index. We just saw a report, I believe it was yesterday evening in this morning's papers, from the government saying that inflation was flat last month.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and William is simply talking about inflation, this idea of increasing the money supply. You increase the money supply, you decrease the value of the existing money. In other words, as they increase the money supply, they destroy the value of your pension, your insurance funds, your CDs, your bank deposits, anything you have that's mediated in money. And, of course, he mentions Bear Stearns. Bear Stearns, of course, is facing total bankruptcy. And so what happens? Why, apparently the Federal Reserve System is going to bail them out, simply creating money out of nothing, destroying the value of your savings, but rescuing Bear Stearns. Is that what's going to happen, William?
Well, they're not going to rescue Bear Stearns. Bear Stearns is headed for oblivion. And along the way, they're going to do as much damage as possible to as many innocent people as it requires in order to make sure that the people at the top of that politically favored failing enterprise are spared the financial consequences of their bad decisions, which is why, of course, you're dealing with socialism for the wealthy, which actually in practice is the only form of socialism that exists. You never have an actual program of redistributing wealth from the wealthy into the hands of the indigent. What you have is a system that making this presumably humanitarian claim, which isn't humanitarian at all, I mean, it violates one of the Ten Commandments, thou shalt not steal, but in the supposed name of redistributing wealth into the hands of the poor, you end up with a mechanism that actually entrenches a wealthy elite that makes itself the broker of pretty much everything that goes on in the given economy, and they always enrich themselves while professing to be doing so in the name of the struggling proletariat. Well, that's the same kind of thing we've got here right now, where the Federal Reserve a central bank designed along the lines of the plank of the Communist Manifesto, which called for the creation of a central bank, is redistributing wealth by inflation, by printing up a quantity of money above and beyond what exists right now, thereby debasing what we have earned through our industry and our thrift. And Bear Stearns is not going to survive. It's probably going to be one of the first banks to fail. Well, it's not even really a bank. That's one of the really important things to recognize here, is that if I understand what it does correctly, they're involved in the hedge fund market. But this went. This is an instance of really telling exercise of power by the Federal Reserve. There is a codicil in the Federal Reserve's laws and bylaws through which they can vote of their board of directors, the board of governors, rather, to approve that loan. And in order to do so, they had to go through a third party, which is why J.P. Morgan got involved. And J.P. Morgan, as you know, and I'm sure that your listeners know, is what we call an insider-connected investment house of the first order. I mean, they were pretty much there at the beginning with the creation of the Federal Reserve and all the other pernicious things that happened in that terrible year of 1913. But once again, this is being done in order to provide a platinum parachute, not merely a gold parachute, but a platinum parachute to the corporate elites who have engineered the disastrous decline of that financial institution. And it's going to go belly up probably before the end of the second quarter of this year. But in the meantime, by doing what the Federal Reserve is doing, it's making it possible for the people who are at the top of that enterprise to land on their feet as cushioned a position as possible. And meanwhile, the rest of us are dealing with gasoline that is vaulting to record highs and food prices that are soaring. The price of everything that we need that's indispensable to our daily lives is going up. The core inflation rate is supposedly kept low, but that's because, once again, everything that's relevant to our daily necessities taken out of the CPI, the core inflation index, doesn't have food or energy among the things that are calculated. They're used to calculate core inflation. And once again, this morning, last night, we saw these soothing reports from the federal government saying, well, inflation remained flat over the last month, which is the purest driven nonsense for anybody who's had to fill up a gas tank or fill up a shopping cart the last couple of weeks. The other thing that's really significant here in terms of describing the trajectory of our economy is the fact that today, for the first time in history, the dollar fell to and then below parity with the Swiss franc. It's never happened before. And in my blog today, I have a chart that was created by one of the market monitoring groups that shows that over the past 6 months, the dollar has managed to shed roughly 20% of its value in comparison with the Swiss franc. And if you run the trend line on that out over the next couple of years, it becomes clear that sometime, if present trends continue, sometime in the year 2010, the dollar will lose all of its value. And I use that term subjectively. The dollar really doesn't have any intrinsic value, but in terms of the purchasing power of that instrument of debt we call the dollar, it will have lost all of that by mid-2010 if current trends continue, and current trends are going to worsen. Once again, a reality check for those who believe that we can borrow our way to prosperity, and it's just not going to happen. It's catching up with us now. It's caught up with us. And now we're starting to feel the consequences.
I certainly agree with you, and I share your concern, William. Go right ahead.
Well, the other thing that I want to bring up here with respect to what's going on with the economy, and specifically what's going on with the dollar here, is the consequences it's going to have socially in terms of the displacement of people from the middle class, below the middle class. We've been seeing over the last 8 or 10 years the ongoing deindustrialization of our country. The last time that we had this type of a shock, this type of a crisis, was in the late 1970s. I vividly remember when I was in high school back in the late 70s and early 80s, the stagflation of the late Carter years, where you had the worst of all possible worlds. You had rising interest rates and just crippling high double-digit inflation and low levels of growth. at the time, we were capable of producing our way out of that economic pit because we were still an industrial nation. We still enjoyed a trade surplus. We were still a creditor nation. We were manufacturing goods that the rest of the world would buy. That's no longer the case. We now import practically everything, whether you're talking about finished products in basic household items, whether you're talking about furniture or appliances or finished electronics goods. Most of the automobiles that we buy are imported. The ones that are manufactured here, primarily, with the exception of ailing automotive interest in Detroit, most of the automobiles produced here in the United States are produced by foreign-owned companies. So we're no longer the country that we were even in 1978, 79, 1980, the last time we faced this kind of a crisis. So if we can't grow our way out, we can't produce our way out, we can't sell our way out, what are we going to do to get out of this mess? We're not going to inflate our way out of this mess, which is Ben Bernanke's approach. What we're going to do by following that course of action is to destroy what remains of the purchasing power of the dollar without having anything to provide here by way of collateral, except perhaps for the resource base of the country, which would be bought up by the people who are holding the notes on our debt. So we're seeing the comprehensive expropriation of the country as a whole, and we're seeing the creation of a dynamic that I think is going to lead to outright feudalism for most of the Americans who had aspired to be in the middle class or who had found some purchase on the lower rungs of the middle class. They're going to be thrust back down into something akin to peonage. I've lived in countries, specifically Mexico and Guatemala, where you had a real sharp division between sort of a quasi-aristocratic upper class, which is very small, and then a vast population of people who were lower class, campesino farmers or people who were just in the permanent state of economic stagnation and had no particular avenue or no particular ambitions to get out of that state. Things have changed somewhat in Latin America since then, not dramatically enough, but somewhat. But I think that we're headed in that direction, quite frankly, in terms of the stratification of our society. And one of the illustrations that you can see of that is the fact that the political class is doing very well. Look at what Congress has done over the last 5 or 6 years in terms of ruining our economy, debauching the value of our currency, such as it is, creating a fully functioning framework for an actual garrison state that would be headed by an autocratic, unaccountable chief executive, tearing great big holes in the Bill of Rights and repealing common law protections of due process that go back to the Magna Carta. This is the handiwork of Congress over the last 6 or 7 years. In a genuinely market economy where these people would have to stand to account for their undertakings and be rewarded or punished accordingly, the people who have that kind of a work record, I think, would be out on the streets hawking pencils or off selling plasma to make a living. But take a look at what's happened instead. Between 2004 and 2006, the net worth of the typical member of Congress increased by 84%.
84%?
Yeah, 84% in that 2 year span between 2004-2006.
It reminds me of that old saying, we have the finest politicians in Washington, D.C. that money could buy.
Exactly. You take a look at the median net worth, break it down by median net worth, and these are figures that are found in a report by the Center for Responsive Politics in Washington. The median net worth of senators is $1.7 million. That is to say that there are as many senators over that amount as there are senators beneath that amount, but they're all very wealthy people. Now, the House of Representatives is supposedly composed of the lowly and humble tribunes of the toiling common people. The median net worth of a member of the House of Representatives is a mere $675,000. So they're not at all representative, really, of the common population in whose name they purport to govern. And it stands to reason that if you make yourself wealthy as a public servant, you're not serving the public.
I remember, of course, Lyndon Johnson had to borrow money to go back to Washington, D.C. as a congressman, and of course, when he left Washington, D.C. as the President of the United States, he was one of the wealthiest men in Texas.
Funny how that happened.
Funny how that happened. We'll be right back here in just a moment with William Grigg, as we begin to analyze, of course, what's going on, they are intentionally destroying the value of our currency. They really do intend to redistribute our wealth to other nations. It's part of a long-range plan laid out in the Earth Charter. Understand it and help us, of course, expose it.
Well, go right ahead. I'm glad that you keep adverting to the Earth Charter and other documents of that sort, because we have to understand that there's a direction in which we're being herded here. It's not as if we're simply being cut adrift from our foundations and being set free on an ice floe in the Bering Sea, as it were. I mean, what's happened is that we're not being set adrift. We're under a powered trajectory here. Our republic and our country, if you will, have been hijacked. It's not as if it's simply lost its course. And the direction that we're going is toward a world that would be very much the sort of thing we're seeing here in the United States and in the former Soviet Union, where you would have this isolated, socially isolated and unaccountable elite. In the former Soviet Union, it was called the nomenklatura. It's an oligarchy that is composed of people who are extremely powerful and thoroughly cynical, utterly without morals or scruples, who make themselves wealthy through the manipulation of political power and who treat the rest of us as a resource to be managed for their benefit. What happened to the former Soviet Union, and I think that it's not very well understood once again, that the same people who ran the Soviet Union are running post-Soviet Russia. It's just that they've somewhat changed the operating system, if you will, that they're using. Well, the framework remains essentially the same. The framework is the same KGB-controlled militaristic state that was established back in 1917. They've just got a slightly different operating system. They're now more of a corporatist type of a system than a supposedly totalitarian socialist system. But what happened after Gorbachev decided to dissolve the Communist Party of the Soviet Union was that prior to December of 1991, when the hammer and sickle flag was struck and the red, white, and blue tricolor of the Russian Republic was raised in its stead, was that the Soviet Communist Party deeded to itself control over all of the resource base of the former Soviet Union, not only in Russia, but also in the 11 other so-called independent republics. And this same process went down in every other republic that had been a constituent member of the former Soviet Union. You had pretty much the same type of people. They came out of the Komsomol, the Communist Youth League. Most of them had connections in the intelligence underground. The people who were running the industries were the so-called red managers, which is to say they were Communist Party functionaries. They weren't hired because of their business acumen. They were put in place because of their loyalty to the party. And the people who were the muscle behind this are the so-called siloviki, which is a Russian word for strong men. They're the folks who came out of the KGB or the GRU, the Soviet Military Intelligence. But they created these capitalist, nominally capitalist enterprises that immediately started to receive all kinds of lucrative support from Wall Street and from the federal government through the Agency for International Development, through various State Department initiatives, through the Export-Import Bank, which was created in 1933 by FDR for the express purpose of underwriting business ventures in the Soviet Union to help build up its economy and build up its industrial base. But all these things went rip-roaring ahead in the early 1990s through the entire reign of Boris Yeltsin, the entire vodka-soaked, incoherent reign of the late Boris Yeltsin. And so you ended up with a situation where the thieves were given unrestricted access to everything of value in the former Soviet Union in the name of capitalism. That's not to say, and I need to make a brief parenthetical clarification.
You'll have to wait until we get back. Just hold that thought for just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan. William is simply talking about what's going on in the Soviet Union, and contrary to everything we've been told, the same people are in control today that were in control before the hammer and sickle flag came down and the tricolor flag was raised, because, of course, it is still under control of the KGB. Andropov came from the KGB, Gorbachev came from the KGB, and Putin came from the KGB. They've changed the name of the organization, but it's all the same. And, of course, before the Soviet Union dissolved, transfer over the control of all of the wealth and the industry and the mining, and all of that was transferred to members of the KGB. Now they don't call them KGB, they call them, well, they call them the oligarchs, but it's the same exact people who are in power, and in large part because of help coming from the United States. The United States has funded the Soviet Union since 1918, and we are still continuing to fund them today. And if you doubt that, you need to get my little pamphlet called The Communist Capitalist Alliance. The title comes from a speech that was given by Solzhenitsyn in 1975 to the AFL-CIO at that time, but of course totally suppressed from the American people, because you could never let the American people know that we were financing the finest enemy that money could buy. So go right ahead, William.
Yeah. It's interesting, if you read books of the sort you just described, another really good one, very revealing, is Dossier, The Secret Life of Armand Hammer. Armand Hammer, of course, being identified as the capitalist path, or the Soviet path to the West, or the capitalist path to the Soviet Union. Armand Hammer is just a perfect example of what we're talking about. He's a mega capitalist whose father was the head of the Communist Party, USA, if memory serves, and who made a huge fortune here in the United States through taxpayer-subsidized and guaranteed investments in various types of undertakings. He didn't own the baking soda company that had sort of a homonym-sounding name, although he bought a share or two in it. He bought not a controlling share, but a fairly sizable share in it, just as a joke, I believe, in the 1970s. But here's somebody who is a nominal capitalist who's actually a corporatist, which is to say he didn't profit through the free market. He profited through his political connections. A very archetypal example of what Adam Smith called the man of system. You know, Adam Smith had a lot of insight and a lot of wisdom with respect to the ways that supposed free marketeers, free traders, actually use politics as a way of profiting at the expense of the common good, rather than subjecting themselves to the discipline of the market, thereby actually helping the common good. But what we see in the former Soviet Union, particularly with respect to the energy sector, I mean, that was what was most coveted of all in the former Soviet Union. They're becoming the Saudi Arabia of natural gas. And this is something that began with the help of the United States, with the help of the U.S. taxpayers, the extorted help of U.S. taxpayers. We didn't volunteer for any of this, of course. And this is something that was kept secret from us, as you point out, Dr. Stan, and something that was a beneficiary of this huge deception here, that the Soviet Union somehow was this colossus that we had to fight through the means that were actually being used to build up the supposed colossus. But way back in the 1970s and the 1980s, they were building pipelines to the West, to Europe specifically, so that the Soviet Union and now post-Soviet Russia would become one of the chief suppliers of natural gas. And that, of course, is run through the Russian state for the benefit of the oligarchs in the former Soviet Union. And you see the same thing taking place now with respect to the energy policies in the United States and elsewhere. And what we're seeing here through the emergence of these different oligarchies, sometimes contending but often collaborating, is the creation of sort of a global overclass. There's a new book by David Rothkopf. He's a man who's sort of vaguely left-wing in his orientation, but he's a pretty good investigative author. A new book entitled Superclass, The Global Power Elite and the World They Are Making. What he talks about is the fact that there is this sort of rootless, stateless, vaguely cosmopolitan group that you can see at meetings like the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland, every January, I believe it is, or clustering around groups such as the Bilderberg Group, the Trilateral Commission, and so forth, who are organizing the world on principles, once again, that would seem to be sort of feudalistic, sort of a 21st century neo-feudalism that they're creating. And this is the same type of an analysis that was published about 15 years ago in a book called Betrayal of the Elite, or Revolt of the Elites, rather. Revolt of the Elites and the Betrayal of Democracy by the late Christopher Lash. He talked about the same group of people. And you can go back once again to Tragedy and Hope, the seminal book way back in the 1960s that Carol Quigley published, that talked about the machinations of the same power elite.
And, of course, they really are the people who are the movers and shakers of the world. They work through the Council on Foreign Relations, the Bilderbergers, the Trilateral Commission, certainly the world banking community, and they control the destiny of the world at the present time, and most people are totally unaware. Well, William, go right ahead there.
Well, just to read a couple of excerpts from a review of this new book, Superclass, The Global Power Elite and the World They Are Making. There's a piece on yesterday's edition of Salon, the online magazine. I just want to read a couple of excerpts here. The first chapter of this book, the author quotes Mark Malik Brown, a British Minister of State and former Deputy Secretary General of the United Nations, recalling what it was like to walk with his wife through a reception in New York for the World Economic Forum. The WEF puts on the famous annual meeting of business leaders, political figures, NGO heads, NGO means non-governmental organization, scientists and other movers and shakers, nicknamed after the small Swiss Alpine town where it takes place, Davos. After crossing the room and shaking countless manicured hands in the process, the couple turned to each other and marveled that, quote, "We walk through the Davos party and know more people than when we're walking across the village green in the town we live in." The reviewer continues, "Brown is far from the only one who could tell such a tale. Davos Man is an epithet coined by the conservative scholar Samuel Huntington to describe the very specific type that attends the conference. These are people who, as Huntington wrote, quote, have little need for national loyalty, view national boundaries as obstacles that thankfully are vanishing, and see national governments as residues from the past whose only useful function is to facilitate the elite's global operations." It's a very important point here that national governments right now are seen primarily as implementing agencies for the whim and the will of this global superclass. And the policies of the United States government right now in bringing about the utter destruction of the dollar as a store of subjective value, and the policies they're pursuing in terms of using our military as this imperial arm of this transnational elite. Right now, the present configuration would be the United States and Great Britain and so-called Coalition of the Willing operating through the United Nations and NATO and so forth. These have nothing to do, all these actions, these policies have nothing to do with the welfare of the citizens of the United States or the future of our republic as a free and independent country. And obviously, when you're talking about the deterioration or the outright demolition of the dollar and the wrecking of our economy, we don't benefit from that, but there are people who do. I mean, the people who are seeking to remold the world closer to their heart's desire, the sort of people that are referred to in this book, that were referred to by Christopher Lash in his, I believe it was 1994 book, The Revolt of the Elite. They want to see the destruction of independent nations. They don't really care that by doing so they wreck havoc and ruin lives.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back here. Well, William Grigg is our guest today, and of course he's simply pointing out that there is this super class, this super elite. He refers to several books. One of them, super class. Is that right? The super class,
yes.
The global elite.
Global power elite and the world they are making.
The global power elite and the world they're making. Well, before we go on, let's go ahead and have William get his blog site out and tell you how you can get a copy of his most recent book, Eclipse of Liberty. Go ahead.
Okay, I appreciate that. My blog is called Pro Libertate, the Latin phrase that means for freedom, and it's something I update between 3 and 5 times a week as my schedule permits. The easiest way to find my blog is to go to the website of the Welch Foundation, which is called The Right Source. The address for that is www.rightsourceonline.com. One word, rightsourceonline.com. If you go to that webpage, at the very top of the homepage, you'll see a banner ad for my new book, Liberty in Eclipse, The War on Terror and the Rise of the Homeland Security State. And when I call it the Homeland Security State, we're not talking about looking to the benefit of the security of the citizenry of the United States. We're talking about the security of the state, the idea that the state has to be protected from the citizens rather than the government protecting the citizens in their unalienable individual rights. And this is something, once again, that has been gestating now for a number of decades, that it was born, if you will, in the aftermath of 9/11, and as a result, we're seeing the steady and accelerating maturation of a full-blown, militarized garrison state. I need to point out, from my own personal experience, I have visited countries that are dictatorships, and I've lived in a couple of them. I lived in Guatemala for a little more than a year, and one of the experiences I had that I think was sort of seminal in creating my perspective on the world when I was 19, 20 years old was going through the coup that removed Efren Rios Montt, the retired general who was at the time the CIA-installed president of Guatemala in 1983. And for about 2.5 weeks after the coup, Guatemala was locked down in the state of martial law. And the environment that I experienced during that two-week period was almost identical to the environment that took place, that was a palpable reality in the aftermath, immediate aftermath of 9/11. For about 2.5 weeks, everywhere we went, uniformed military personnel carrying automatic weapons were a ubiquitous sight. And then they sort of faded into the background, but they were always there. They would make their presence known in various ways. And to a strikingly similar extent, or to a shocking extent, we're seeing a strikingly similar environment being created here in the United States. It's a little bit more subtle because we're seeing the militarization of our local police as basically an army of occupation, but every once in a while you'll get a very vivid demonstration of the fact that we're still very much a country which is on a martial footing. I witnessed the fact that now there are plans to have some of the Amtrak trains play host to armed guards, armed police guards. And that's sort of, by armed police guards, I'm not talking about some inconspicuous guy in plain clothes packing a sidearm. I'm talking about somebody with a military rifle aboard these trains. And that's sort of a change in the climate, a change in the atmosphere of our country that I saw happen in Guatemala when it was literally under martial law. And so that's what I mean when I talk about the homeland security state. Why do I call liberty an eclipse? An eclipse is a passing phenomenon. It's my hope, forlorn as it may be, that we're able to see a restoration of normalcy within our lifetime. It's not within our lifetime, within the lifetime of our children. But that's once again available through the website of the Welch Foundation, www.rightsourceonline.com. And if you go to that page, once again, scroll down about a third of the way down the page, look to the left-hand border of the screen, you'll find my photograph, and there's a hot link next to my photograph that will take you to my daily blog, Pro Libertate.
All right, fine. I certainly recommend it to our listeners that they do go there. William's information is vitally important, and it's being picked up not infrequently there at World Affairs Brief, which I go to every morning as well. So go right ahead, then, with this story that you were truly telling.
We were talking about this overclass, or this power elite. A power elite, of course, was a term coined in the 1950s by the left-wing sociologist C. Wright Mills, who got a lot of it right in spite of the fact that he fell for a lot of their tricks. For instance, he was a supporter of Fidel Castro. That doesn't entirely impeach his analysis any more than the fact that Carol Quigley, author of Tragedy and Hope and mentor to Bill Clinton, among others, was sort of a left-leaning scholar and academic. The analysis is sound, and I suspect the Rothkopf's book is probably going to be similar. Christopher Lash's book, which I've referred to a couple of times, Revolt of the Elites, is perhaps even more valuable because Christopher Lash has actually been a practicing communist, a socialist of the Marxist variety, through most of his life until the last couple of decades when he became a species of social conservative. But all these people talk about this readily identifiable pool, and it's remarkably small in number for a planet that contains how many billions of people, that will materialize at a standard number of events every year and who punch well above their weight in terms of influence they have over the destinies of nations and entire regions of the world. Rothkopf, and I'm reading once again from this review, announced that he and his researchers have identified just over 6,000 people who match his definition of the superclass, that is, who have met complicated, albeit vaguely defined, metrics designed to determine the ability to regularly influence the lives of millions of people in multiple countries worldwide. These include heads of state and religious and military leaders, even the occasional pop star like Bono, who's of course the Bono's the I shouldn't pronounce it Bono. That would be the late Congressman Sonny Bono, who had been a pop star in his own right. But Bono is the lead singer and frontman for the Irish rock band U2. But this group also, the core membership is businessmen, hedge fund managers. There we go again. The same group of people, like the Bear Stearns folks, are being bailed out by the Federal Reserve, technology entrepreneurs, and private equity investors. Money alone isn't enough. You can be fabulously wealthy, but you have to have some kind of political clout as well. And that brings us back into this concept of corporatism, which is a system, and I think it's useful to define it once again, a system in which the risks of investment are subsidized, the losses are socialized, and the profits are privatized. That's what we mean when we talk about corporatism. It isn't free market capitalism. Free market capitalism, you're on your own hook. You take your risks. That's what it means to be an entrepreneur. It means that you're a risk taker, and you reap your own rewards. That's how fortunes used to be built in this country in the 19th century and in much of the 20th century. And today, of course, what really matters, and this is one of the reasons why you've seen this increase in net worth for congressmen of 84% in a two-year period, just this decade, is an illustration of the fact that what matters today would be the political connections that you make and your success in engineering these relatively risk-free investments and these risk-free undertakings where you put the taxpayer on the hook for your risks and your losses. And that's the system that has really blossomed in the full malignant flower of its evil this decade under Bush and Cheney. And both of them are really exemplars par excellence of what we're talking about. Neither of those guys has ever held an honest job. Neither of them has ever succeeded in any of the undertakings that they've been involved in. I remember during the vice presidential debate back in 2000 between Dick Cheney and Joseph Lieberman, who really is almost unbearable to watch or to listen to. I mean, very, very rarely do you find somebody who is just such a repulsive spectacle of sanctimony and unearned self-regard. But in that voice of tremulous piety that Holy Joe so often affects, he made a point that Dick Cheney had made out very well for himself during the 1990s, talking about all the hundreds of millions of dollars that he'd brought in as the CEO of Halliburton. And Dick Cheney had the temerity to say, "Yes, I made a fortune and the government had nothing to do with it," which, of course, was a staggering lie, because the government has everything to do with the fortunes of Halliburton. Halliburton is a charter member of the military-industrial complex. They've never done anything that hasn't involved in some way, shape, or form government subsidy and government protection.
Not only that, but of course they get, and they're still getting, these non-bid contracts.
Exactly.
In other words, ordinarily when you have a government contract, it's a bid contract, and the bid goes to the lowest bidder, but of course the business goes to the lowest bidder, but that's not the way it was with Halliburton. Nobody bids on it. They're told they're going to get $400, $500, $600 million or $1 billion to do this out of the other thing, and of course whether they do it or not isn't important. They just get the money anyway.
Exactly. Halliburton, not insignificantly, has been involved in building up the industrial infrastructure and the multiple use including military applicable technology base of countries like Iran and China. I remember about 10 or 12 years ago that Halliburton was involved in a huge energy undertaking in communist China that involved building up the nuclear capacity. And there were multiple use technologies involved, which is to say technologies that could be converted to military applications. And one of the things that happened about that time was that Cheney gave a speech praising the Overseas Private Investment Corporation and the Export-Import Bank for the role that they had played in promoting ventures of that sort in countries like China. And what a wonderful return that the companies who were the recipients of this taxpayer-funded or taxpayer-subsidized largesse have received. And that struck me as, once again, just a dramatic and incredibly revealing example of the embedded evil of the system we live in, that in a public setting, on the record, Dick Cheney could be inviting people to get aboard this gravy train to where they could get the U.S. taxpayers on the hook to conduct these business ventures in countries that are being built up, regimes that are being built up as potential threats. You take a look at what's going on with Iran right now. It's pretty much even money or worse that we're going to see some kind of a conflict with Iran before the end of the Bush administration's term. And the reason for doing this, purportedly, is because of the Iranian nuclear weapons program. Well, who was it who helped build the Iranian nuclear capacity? People talk about the role that was played by France in the 1970s, both in Iran and in Iraq. The fact is that the United States built the nuclear capacity under the Shah's reign back in the 1970s, and as recently as the 1990s, you had Halliburton directly involved in helping to build up not only the oil infrastructure in Iran, but also the nuclear infrastructure in Iran. The same people who are now talking about demolishing this infrastructure are the ones who built it up in the first place, and they got the taxpayers on the hook to build it up. They'll put the taxpayers on the hook to reconstruct it, assuming that we go to war, to knock it down.
The best enemies money could buy.
Exactly. It's the same syndrome. And it's not going to stop anytime soon because it's just too darn profitable. Although every once in a while you'll see that even some of the people in this overclass find themselves colliding with reality. Witness what's going on right now with the Carlyle Group and its investment arm. The Carlyle Group is one of the marquee or boutique elements of the military-industrial complex. They have all kinds of people with military and intelligence connections who are corporate officers of that group, including the Bush family, and it's an entity that has participants from the Arab world. Many Saudis are involved in it. It has connections to the bin Laden family. By the way, this book, The Overclass, points out that Osama bin Laden is pretty typical of the overclass here, sort of a stateless global presence who is very much connected to the same overclass as the Bush family and the other people who were supposedly involved in this world struggle against terrorism. The Carlyle Group has an investment arm that is not able to make a margin call. They've got a $500 million margin call they're not able to make because they got involved once again in hedge funds and derivatives. And it's likely, I've not been able to find out for sure yet, but it's likely that the Bush family managed to get out before things got really dicey. There's a history involved here of people like the Bushes being tipped off before things go pear-shaped and getting out with their investment capital intact. But they're lining up for a bailout. They had received promises of a bailout from various Gulf area sovereign wealth funds last fall, and they're in the same situation that Citicorp is in. Citicorp had a huge buy-in from two sovereign wealth funds and a Saudi prince to the tune of billions of dollars. And just last week, the Arab investors, taking a look at what was going on with Citicorp's balance sheet, said, well, you know, they're in a far worse position than we imagined. They're going to have to raise some more money, or we might have to pull out. I suspect the same thing is going to happen with Carlyle. The likely outcome would be that the Federal Reserve will do with them what it's done with Bear Stearns today. You know, simply find some creative way to counterfeit another increment of so-called money, stealing out of our bank accounts once again in order to enrich the bottom line of these concerns, at least long enough to permit the graceful exit of the people who are part of this overclass. That's how the system works. It works this way in the United States. It works in a remarkably similar way in the Soviet Union, the former Soviet Union, and Russia. The biggest difference is that in Russia, you actually have dead bodies on the streets every once in a while. And I think that's something we're going to start seeing here in the United States as well as things get rougher and blunter.
Well, I fear that you're really right. Of course, the thing is, people must understand there's always been a very close working relationship between the leaders of the United States and the leaders of Russia, but they could never let the American people know that. And certainly we know very well that if you've ever been to the headquarters of the Council on Foreign Relations, as I have on a number of occasions, and certainly look back through the records, all of the leading communists have come to pay homage to the Council on Foreign Relations. In fact, there, right next to the desk of the head of the library there, they have the copy of Foreign Affairs magazine that Lenin read. They have it, they're preserved. It's one of their most treasured possessions. Why would anybody want to treasure a copy of Foreign Affairs that Lenin, who was a mass murderer, had read? Why, he is highly esteemed by the ruling class of America.
Well, not just the ruling class in America. I really think that Lenin, and I didn't know, by the way, about what you'd said concerning the personalized copy of Foreign Affairs that had been in the hands of the sanctified Lenin. That doesn't surprise me, but I had not known about that. But I believe that Lenin is probably the most successful and most influential political figure of the modern era, modern in this case, beginning in, say, in the period beginning about 1913 or so. I think the modern era began, quite frankly, with that horrible year where we had the United States government taken over by people who were starting to engineer our eventual decline into this corporate socialism with the advent of the Federal Reserve and the rest of it, the income tax being another instrument of that revolution. But I think the most influential politician in the modern era has been Lenin, because he digested politics into a very simple proposition. What matters in politics, he said, is the question kto kvo, which is Russian for who whom, or in other words, who does what to whom. That's the fundamental question, the fundamental equation of politics, according to Lenin. What's important is to be on the delivering side rather than the receiving side of that equation, to be the who rather than the whom. And the who, once again, would be this overclass we're talking about, this superclass, this elite, this oligarchy, this nomenclatura. They are the who, and the rest of us are the whom. You know, ironically enough, it was Jerry Lewis who, in one of his movies, I think it was, I can't even remember the title of it now, but he made a distinction between people and persons.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment here. Go ahead, William. You were talking about Jerry Lewis?
Yeah, Jerry Lewis is sort of, once again, an unlikely fountain of wisdom. I've already adverted to the wisdom of William Shatner. I might as well go the whole distance and talk about Jerry Lewis as a great philosopher of the human condition. But he once drew a distinction between people and persons. Persons, he said, are important figures who are noted and reported on and dealt with individually, whereas people are just the rest of us. And so, you know, the who would be the persons and the whom would be the people, and we're the whom. We are the people rather than the persons in that alignment. And so Lenin said, once again, politics is entirely the outworking of this fundamental question of who does what to whom. And every single government in existence today, without exception generally, although there are some specific exceptions in terms of individual politicians, every government in existence today operates to some extent on the basis of Lenin's equation. You take a look at the way, once again, that Congress acts when Congress, which is, they're supposed to be public servants, when they are enriching themselves so extravagantly in an economy that is going so badly, with a state that is being managed so poorly, and wars that are grinding on without apparent success or an end point, you take a look at everything that a government is supposed to do in order to be considered successful from the perspective of individual rights. Our government is doing exactly the opposite, and Congress is making out like bandits and being rewarded so lucratively. That's a pretty good illustration of the politics of whom. I mean, they're obviously looking out for somebody other than the people in whose name they supposedly act. And that, I think, attests to the long-term malignant influence that Lenin has had on politics. And so it doesn't surprise me to find out that there was this treasured icon at the Council on Foreign Relations headquarters there at Pratt House, which would be a copy of Foreign Affairs that had actually been in the hands of Lenin, who was the architect of the modern totalitarian state and the founding totalitarian dictator of the modern era.
They even keep it under glass there, and they have a very low intensity light because they don't want to damage the pages of that revered copy of Foreign Affairs magazine.
Oh, that's amazing. That would be the direct counterpart to the sacred relic there in Moscow, where they have the human remains, or at least some wax figure that's a simulacrum of the mortal remains of Lenin, which is displayed in remarkably similar fashion, you know, as an object of veneration by the masses. One of the things I've always wanted to do was to travel to Russia, and one of the reasons for doing that would be to find out exactly how much of the iconography of the old Soviet state remains under Putin.
Hold that thought, we'll be right back. Well, our guest this evening has been William Grigg. William, we're out of time. It's always a pleasure having you. Thank you so very much for being with us, and
look forward
to having you on again next week.
Thanks so much. God bless.
Good night. You too. Bye-bye. Well, I hope you enjoy our conversation with William Grigg. I know I always do. but really to understand what he's talking about, this ruling elite that controls America. You really need to get Professor Quigley's book, Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World in Our Time. It was actively suppressed. Somebody came in and bought up the publisher, Macmillan, and destroyed the place to the first half of the book so it could not be reproduced. And if you doubt that, we have an interview with Professor Quigley where he tells that. It is available when you get the Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World in Our Time, and you can get the Tragedy and Hope special, which includes the book Foundations, Their Power and Influence, which has been suppressed for half a century as well. And then the interview, and then, of course, the book Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World in Our Time. And the only reason, of course, it's available at all is because somebody pirated the book and published it illegally. And then, of course, when Professor Quigley could not get the publisher to do anything about the pirate, and the pirate then offered Professor Quigley a stipend for the ability, the rights to publish it, and Professor Quigley agreed and took, I think we got $3 a copy. Of course, in those days, $3 was quite a bit of money. Today, it's hardly, won't even get you a cup of coffee at Starbucks. But, so we do have the book, and it's now being published by one of my friends, Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World in Our Time. And, of course, the book was actively suppressed by the ruling elite because it tells about the secret society that the Council on Foreign Relations is a front for. The CFR, which is our government, the president, always comes from there. If he doesn't, why, the vice president does. And the president, as is the case today, is controlled by a member of the CFR. Current case, it's Dick Cheney controlling George Bush. And George Bush really is simply a figurehead for the people that Dick Cheney represents from the power elite. So, and then, of course, to understand what's going on in Russia, you need to get my pamphlet, The Communist-Capitalist Alliance. It's a small little pamphlet, but it's got a great deal of information. The book, Wall Street and the Bolshevik Revolution, written by Professor Sutton, and The Best Enemy Money Could Buy, written by Professor Sutton, and my interview with Professor Sutton, The Best Enemies Money Could Buy. It's available on VHS or certainly on DVD. And then, of course, you need to understand that America has financed communism since its inception. And until you understand that, nothing really makes sense. Let me suggest my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, which goes into great detail and on that and gives you quotations from people who were very, very close to Lenin, who never understood why Lenin was so subservient to the people from the United States and from Great Britain. That's Brotherhood of Darkness. It's available, of course, in book form. And if you'd like our telephone number, like to learn more, my telephone number is 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. But what all of the commentators have missed, of course, is the spiritual forces behind the ruling elite who rule the world. And of course, that's covered in my book, Brotherhood of Darkness. It's covered in my talk, the CD of that, which is available from Radio Liberty. And then in my talk on the Forbidden Secret. The Forbidden Secret, which is available in DVD, comes with the syllabus. And then, of course, in the four-tape set, The Secret Behind the Secret. And, of course, then in the four-tape set on the supernatural. There really are forces out there that most people are unaware of, the supernatural, and there's a book that goes with that, The Beautiful Side of Evil. And then, of course, to get into the really spiritual forces behind the Bilderbergers, let me suggest the book, The Satanic Crimes. There's a four-tape set that comes with that. And it goes into a great deal of detail on the Bilderbergers. We do actually have two books on the Bilderbergers. We have a four-tape set on the Bilderbergers. We have a DVD on the Bilderbergers called Endgame. Our number, 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. And then please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection until Monday. May the Lord be with you.